Well, we're going to start a new series this morning. Before we do, I just want to ask, like, are you like me and that you have, like, that closet at home that no one's allowed to see? Like, it's the place where when company's coming, stuff just kind of, like, goes there. Or maybe you're really like me, which is every time you open your garage, if anyone is present, you're like, I'm sorry. like this doesn't actually, like, represent who I am. Because it's such a mess in there, right? It's a place like I don't want people to see. I wish that it were just the closet, and I wish that it were just the garage. But if you could see like my screen on my computer and all like the open things and all the tabs and all the stuff going on, every time someone looks over my shoulder at my computer, I'm like, I want it to be true that that's not really me. But after the closet, after the garage, after the computer screen, it is who I am. Okay, it's who I am. And I want to say, like, there's just certain things in our lives sometimes that we just kind of, like, try to keep them hidden. We try to keep them from view, okay? And I say all that because we're going to start a series today in a piece of the Bible that sometimes we try to keep hidden from view, okay? It's this book of Ecclesiastes. It has a reputation for being kind of dark. Like, by dark, I mean, like, depressing. But there's really a lot more going on here. So we're actually calling this Surprising Hope, okay? Surprising Hope. We're going to read some things this morning before, like, we finish with what we're going to share. We're going to read some things that are just, like, on the nose, pretty depressing, okay? But the book of Ecclesiastes as a whole is actually a message of hope. It's a message of hope, and we want that to come through. And we want it to come through so much that we're doing this thing, okay, that's a QR code. We're doing this thing where it started Wednesday, okay, or Thursday. It started this week, okay, where we're sending daily messages from Ecclesiastes. It gives you, like, just a couple verses from Ecclesiastes to read, a little affirmation, and then a prayer. So I would encourage you, if you haven't signed up for these, do this. You can use this QR code. You can go to mylcc.info because the truth of the matter is, and we're just laying it out here. Sometimes when we look at the book of Ecclesiastes, okay, when we look at the book of Ecclesiastes, it's going to take us through some really difficult things before it gets to a place where the hope is front and center. Okay. The hope comes in, like, just kind of little glimmers. But we really want to encourage everybody to get those messages on a daily basis. Read through this book together. It's a fascinating passage of scripture. But today we're going to set the stage. Okay, we're going to set the stage with the book of Ecclesiastes in chapter 1. And I want to just start by saying there's a lot of theories about what's going on in Ecclesiastes. Like when scholars look at the book of Ecclesiastes, when Old Testament scholars, Hebrew scholars look at the book of Ecclesiastes, there's a lot of theories about it. Okay, when you pick up like different books about Ecclesiastes and everything, you may get a lot of different opinions. Here's what we just want to say about it. The book of Ecclesiastes is honestly not that very long. Okay, it's not that very long. It's not very long. It would take about 30 minutes or so to read it from beginning to end, okay? To read it from beginning to end. And there's recent scholarship. There's these things as they get studied more and more, that there's evidence that it might have not actually been written first. It might have been spoken. Like, it might have been, like a spoken word, a spoken message that went out. And there's kind of evidence, too, that it might actually be kind of like satire or dark comedy. Okay, that it might be stand-up comedy from the ancient world. Okay, possibly. Now, when you read it, you may go like, "I don't think so." If it is, it's very different from most of the comedy that we experience now. But it's possible that that's sort of like what's going on. That the teacher in Ecclesiastes, the person we'll talk about who wrote this or who did this in just a minute, but like it's possible that what they're trying to do is they're trying to sort of like subvert your expectations about what teaching or what the word might contain in order to get you thinking about deeper questions and lead you to a particular place. Okay? And so, obviously, in the nature of this, we're going to spend 9 weeks in Ecclesiastes. In the nature of this, we do this in chunks. Like, we look at it in chunks of Ecclesiastes. But I would strongly, strongly encourage you, okay? Like I said, about 30 minutes it would take to read Ecclesiastes. I would strongly encourage you sometime in the next few weeks, sit down with the book of Ecclesiastes and just read through it, the whole thing, okay? We're sending you if you sign up, we're sending you the daily little messages that are just going to have like 2-3, at the most 6 or 7 verses to read and a little affirmation from Ecclesiastes. But at some point, read through the whole thing. If it feels heavy, it kind of is. If it feels difficult to read, grab like a translation that's a little more of a paraphrase, like something like the Message of the Living Bible. Go ahead and do that. Give yourself permission to just read through it and absorb what it's saying. But I do want to jump in. We want to jump in and start talking about it. And we want to begin in the very first verse, Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 1. It identifies the words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Okay? It's right where it starts, right where it starts. Now, there's a lot of folks that identify this and will say Ecclesiastes was written by King Solomon. It is quite possible that it was given by King Solomon, but it doesn't say Solomon. Okay? It doesn't say Solomon. And in fact, in the other places that Solomon we know wrote Proverbs and Song of Solomon, it does use his name. It doesn't use his name here in Ecclesiastes. So if he wrote it, this is just different. Okay? It's just different. The word it does use is this word teacher, the teacher. And it's the Hebrew word kohelet. It's kind of a weird word. A teacher, the way we think of teacher, it's probably not the best way. But it was more like an orator, like someone who in the public square would have stood up and given an address. Okay? So it sort of begins with, these are the words of the orator. These are the words of the kohelet, is that Hebrew word. We just don't really have a great sort of analogy for what it would be. And so teacher is the way that it comes out. Now, it does say son of David, and it does say king in Jerusalem again, which leads folks to this conclusion that it is Solomon. And that's not entirely, it wouldn't be unusual because this phrase, son of David, is only used 8 times in the Old Testament. This is one of them, okay? And 6 of the other 7 times, it is Solomon, son of David, okay? Solomon, son of David. But again, it doesn't say Solomon, so we want to be a little careful with that. It doesn't call him by name. And also, the book doesn't really follow Solomon's pattern. Solomon's pattern of life was, if we know the story of Solomon, he really begins good. Like he's on a good path. He's doing the right things. But then he, kind of devolves into, bad patterns and idolatry. Ecclesiastes is going to go the exact opposite direction, where it says, the teacher here, the speaker, the order, they say, I started bad. I did all kinds of bad things. And then it goes the other way, and it ends good. That doesn't mean it wasn't Solomon. I'm just saying it's different, okay? It's different from what we know about Solomon. But here's the thing I do want to say about this this son of David thing, okay? It's, like I said, it's used 8 times in the Old Testament, the son of David. But fascinating, it's used 17 times in the New Testament. Okay? And every one of those uses is in the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Okay? And it's used to identify Jesus. Okay? And so, the first Christians, the earliest Christians, the disciples, the followers of Jesus, the authors of our New Testament, the authors of our gospels, they never go back here and quote Ecclesiastes. There are no quotations of Ecclesiastes in the New Testament directly. But this idea of son of David was critical to understanding who Jesus was. Okay? So this message that we're going to see in Ecclesiastes, and again, I encourage you, it's a big, long message. We're going to see it in pieces, but it's a big, long message. This message is going to be central to understanding Jesus, who Jesus is, his identity. Okay? And so as we read this, we want to keep that in mind, okay? We want to keep that in mind. All right, that's just verse 1. We're going to do 11 verses today, so. All right, verse 2. Then it says this. It gets real fun right away, okay? It says, meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Here's the teacher, son of David, king of Jerusalem. Here's what he says. Meaningless, meaningless, says teacher, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. There's your theme for the book. Okay, I said it's going to get dark. Okay, it's going to get depressing. But he starts there. Now, it's actually also another interesting way. It's said here in Spanish, it's vanidad de vanidades. Okay, which it's like what that actually captures a little bit of the phrasing better than meaningless, meaningless. It's actually sort of like meaningless of meaninglessness. Okay, most scholars think it's a play on words. You guys know the Hebrew temple had these like different levels where people could enter, and the furthest place in where they would go to actually meet God was called the Holy of Holies. Okay? Holy of Holies. This is actually likely a play on that phrase, that there is a Holy of Holies where God resides. But what the teacher is going to talk about here is the exact opposite. It's as far away from that as you can get. It's the vanity of vanities. It's the emptiness of empty. Or empty of emptiness, sorry. Okay? Like, it's just hollow. It's vacant. It's the exact opposite of where God is. The author is telling you right off the bat what they're doing. Okay? Telling you right off the bat what they're doing. We're going to be talking about how far away from God can you get. Can we keep that in mind? It's not giving you instructions for what you should do right now. It's telling you how far away from God can we get. Okay? And it uses that word, and we're going to talk about this in just a second. It uses this word, meaningless or vanidad, vanity. It uses it four times in that verse. And I think actually that's going to set up four things that are going to happen in the rest of the passage. But what does this word meaningless mean? What does it mean for something to be meaningless? Because it's also, we have to understand the language here is so specific and so important. And this word is used over 30 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. It's the thematic word. Okay? It's a thematic word, and it's the Hebrew word hevel. Okay? Hevel. It is translated, meaningless is a good translation for it, but literally it means like vapor or breath. That's where it comes from. It's like just something that exists, but it's not solid. Okay? It's also translated as emptiness, a fantasy, something that is futile, a mirage, or a delusion. Okay? It's language that's used, commonly used in the Old Testament to describe the idols, and their power. Their power was hevel. It was meaningless. It was empty. Like, the idols in the Old Testament, in the pagan world, they had a form, they had a shape, but there was no real power in them. And so the author here, the teacher in Ecclesiastes, says, hevel of hevels. Everything is hevel. It's all hevel. It's all empty. Okay? So you keep using that word. Okay? Meaningless, empty. We're going to use it a lot. Let's make sure we understand what it means. Okay? Let's make sure we understand what it means. Next big idea, right out of the chute. He says this. What? He asks a question. So he gives us his main idea. This whole thing, all of this is meaningless. It's all pointless. And then he asks like a key question. What do people gain from their labors at which they toil under the sun? Okay? What are we all gaining from the work that we're doing? What's the point? What's the meaning? What's the purpose of it? Why are we even doing it? This is cut to the chase. What are we here for? It's like a big question. Does any of this have any purpose, any meaning? But it's that last phrase, the under the sun, that's critical here, okay? Because he's doing a thought experiment, okay? He's doing a thought experiment. He's trying to enter into this idea that says, what if there's nothing except what's under the sun, okay? Like, what if when we kind of look out there, you have the sun and the world around you, and what if that's all there is just what we can see and what we can hear and what we can touch? What if that's all that there is? Okay? What if that's it? And he says, that's hevel. It's meaningless. So right off the bat, he's bringing us into a view of reality, a view of the way things, people like live their lives and the way that people perceive reality. What if this is all that there is? What if there's nothing other than just the physical world in which we live? Okay? So he's asking you and me, any reader, anyone who would have heard this, he's asking us to sort of like put on an idea. To put on an idea and to wear it, okay? And then to follow that idea to its logical conclusion. And he says some more really fun things, okay? He says, under the sun, generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, they return again. It's all just this cycle of nature. It's just happening. It's empty. It's meaningless. It just goes on and on and on. We're just on this merry-go-round, right? One day and then the next. Seen Groundhog Day, right? You know, someone actually studied Groundhog Day. This is half-baked internet research here. Someone said that in the movie Groundhog Day, if you don't know the premise, the guy keeps waking up and reliving the same day over and over again. Someone measured it out, and they think that it's supposed to represent 30 years. Okay? I thought that was fascinating, right? But isn't that, like, true of kind of a lot of life? Like, we go through life, we grow up, we get our education, we get into a job, and then we get up, we, you know, get cleaned up, get dressed, have our coffee, get in the car, go to job, do the job, come home, put on the show, go to bed. We get up, we get cleaned up, have the coffee, go to the job, right? Like, and what the author here is saying is, that's life. It just keeps happening. It just keeps happening, day after day, and it's really burdensome. It's really burdensome. In fact, he says, that's part of his, like, this is the first of the hevel. I think he uses that word hevel four times in what we call verse 2. And I think he's going to point out four things that he thinks are empty or meaningless. And the first one is that nature does what it wants without noticing mankind. If our view is, if we put on the glasses or the lens and say, all we have is nature, that's it. It's just the natural world. There's nothing like beyond the sun. Everything is under the sun. It's just this world, this life. And there's nothing other than this. He says, look, I'll tell you something that's pointless. Nature does not care about you one way or another. It's going to do what it's going to do, and you just have to respond to it. Okay? How's that for a great thought? Okay? And this does coincide with even what we see in the New Testament. Paul writes in Romans chapter 8, he says, creation was subjected to frustration. He's right, like, creation is frustrating, not by his choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the freedom of glory of the children of God. See, there's this contrast. There's a different view of the natural world that the author here is saying, if there's nothing outside of this reality, there's kind of no hope. All we get is the frustration part of this. Frustration of nature. That it's just, we've just been subjected to it. We didn't ask to be born. We didn't ask to live this life. We're just stuck in it. We're just stuck in it. And that's our first hevel. Nature just goes and does its thing. And that's kind of pointless and meaningless. There seems to be nothing of value in it. It's empty. Okay? He goes on in verse 8, and he says, all things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. It's wearisome, right? I can see it all, and you know what happens? I want to be like, well, okay, what's the next thing to see? I can hear it all. And then I go, okay, but what's the next thing to hear? Like, it doesn't really satisfy. And we know that this is the case, right? Go ahead, consume things, right? The second hevel, we can neither see nor hear enough to actually make a difference in our own life. Like, we can't consume enough experiences, entertainment, knowledge, learning. We can't consume enough to fill us up. It's still empty in the midst of all that. But seeing and hearing are addicting, right? There's an addiction to it. It's why we binge watch, right? The last 7 episodes I watched, boy, they didn't fill me up, but you know what will? The 8th. That's going to make a difference, right? Scrolling. Boy, I don't seem to feel any better. I'm not getting much from this. I better keep doing it. The answer must be just down the next page. It's part of the addiction of pornography. It just is. It's this momentary pleasure, but there's always the next thing beyond it. It never fills us up. It's this low level of pleasure with just diminishing returns. It never really satisfies. It's empty. It's meaningless. It's vanity. Right? It promises things when we look at it, but it doesn't actually deliver on what it's promising. And the teacher is pointing this out to us. The eye just never has enough. The ear is never full. Like it never really fills us. This is just hevel. It's wearisome. He goes on. He says, what has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun. That gets quoted a fair amount. Hear that? Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was here already, long ago. It was here before our time. He goes again, this is tiresome. This constant chasing after something new. Right? Look, we live in a new obsessed culture. Right? New phones every year. New cars, new clothes. Like we just do. Let's be honest with it. But the deeper idea here isn't necessarily about like financial consumption of new things. There's actually sort of running in the background of this text, there's this idea of like, look, we just keep doing the same things over and over again. We just keep doing them. We keep repeating the same mistakes over and over. Like, we keep trying to grasp something new, but it doesn't deliver for us. And so, you know, we, like, just as cultures, as individuals, like, we keep sort of, like, singing the same songs on the same themes. He's saying, like, cultures repeat the same mistakes. People make the same mistakes over and over again, and it just all seems pointless. You know, we say history may not repeat itself, but it's definitely like singing the same song. It's echoing the same themes. We just keep trying the same stuff, and it all feels really heavy and burdensome. We get tired of it, right? Like, I don't know about you, but like, I have legitimately, over the last month, just said to like my phone, like, go away. I don't want to hear any more about this stuff. And I get it, like, I have civic duty. And I get it, like, I need to be informed. I get it. But just wearing that weight of all the mistakes and all the things and all the animosity and all the stuff, and it just, ugh. There's no, like, new solutions. It's the same old arguments over and over again. I feel it. I feel this desperation of the meaninglessness, the vanity, the hevel. It's like we never learn. It's pretty depressing. But don't worry, it gets worse. I find this verse to be the worst in this passage for me. No one remembers the former generations. And even those yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. Thank you, Mr. Teacher. Things were going fine, but oh, man. Oof. To be alive, to live, is to face the reality that this is temporary and memory fades. It's just a truth. It's a reality. And when we put on those lenses of the just the natural world, if that's all there is, this is not good news. This is not good news. What does it matter? I said this one hits me hard. Let me say it bluntly. Look, we're all going to be forgotten anyway. That's like the fourth hevel Said he says that, used that word four times in that verse. And I think he points out four things that are meaningless in this section. This is the fourth. Time is going to spin and turn, and it's going to go. It is not waiting for you to make your mark. It is not waiting for you to rise up to that place of prominence so that everyone will remember you. It's just happening. It's just happening. And if this world, this natural world, is all that there is, there's no hope in that. There's no hope in it. It's meaningless. I had a big round birthday in the last year. 50 hit me pretty hard in this area. It really did. I had a lot of just change and upheaval in my life anyway. My kids are going to college. They don't even remember to call me. Call me. At least pick up your phone when I call you. Sometimes they do watch our service. But like, what's it all been about these 50 years? I'm asking those questions. And if I've got less time left, what's that going to be about? Is it about being remembered? It's a tough reality. We're confronted with these difficult questions. And avoiding the questions can't be the answer. Like, the author here, the teacher, it's not like he's being cruel or mean and bringing up things that just wouldn't be, like, realities unless he brought them up. No, they're realities. They're true whether I choose to look at them and acknowledge them or not. He's just bringing them to the forefront. Like bills that come to the house, right? I can just toss them aside and ignore them. But they don't go away. And they compound interest and late fees and penalties. And eventually someone comes to the house or the authority steps in and says, you've got to pay up on this. Like, I can ignore this stuff if I choose, but I do it rather foolishly. The debt is going to be collected. It's going to be collected. And we need to confront these things, these questions, these realities. Remember, the teacher in Ecclesiastes is conducting a thought experiment. He's putting these things in front of us, but he's not doing it, again, just to bum us out, just to depress us. He's wearing a mask or playing a role to force us to face the truth of our situation if the only thing that exists is what's under the sun. If we choose to live a life that's just under the sun, then all this is meaningless. This is his point. It's all pointless. It's all meaningless. It's empty. It's vanity. It's a mirage, a delusion. It looks like it's going to give you something, but it can't deliver. It just can't do it. And he's doing it to try and, the big long story, we're going to give away the ending. We're going to do it on a regular basis because we need to remember that this is the point, is to get us to ask what lies beyond the sun. That's the point of Ecclesiastes. It's not just to bum us out about the meaninglessness of our lives. It's to get us to face the reality in which we live. What's beyond the sun? If this is life under the sun, what's past that? I don't avoid the meaninglessness by just not thinking about it, by pretending it doesn't exist. I do something about it by acknowledging the reality in which I find myself, which is there's got to be more than this. There's got to be more. So what lies beyond the sun? Is there more out there? And I wrestled with like how to bring this home, but here's an analogy, okay? Here's an analogy. We have a cultural way of saying, like, well, you know, things that are behind the curtain. Remember my garage door? What's behind the garage door? Okay? And I don't like to open, and I don't like people to see it because it is embarrassing. Okay? But we also, like, we have a curtain. Right? We have a curtain back here. And I want to ask, like, what's behind the curtain? Just like we might ask, like, what's beyond the sun? What's behind the curtain? I'm going to check real quick. Okay, yeah, all right. So, do this. What's behind the curtain? What's beyond the sun? What the author of Ecclesiastes is trying to get us to realize is that there's more than just what we experience. There's more than what we experience. It's what the Hebrews, this is Yahweh. This is the highest name for God. Read from right to left, it's YHWH. They wouldn't even utter it. They wouldn't say it. They had to do fancy things with the words and the letters because there's no vowels in there and people didn't know how to say it as time went on. And so they combined words together. And several thousand years later, we get the English word Jehovah. But in your Bible, this is the word Lord, L-O-R-D, all in capital letters. What's beyond the sun? This is what the author of Ecclesiastes is trying to get us to reckon with. There's more. There's more than what we experience on this earth under the sun. And it's God, the I Am. He is real. Do we believe it? But do we believe it not just in a way that says, yeah, I accept it, but do we believe it in a way that actually changes the way we go about our day to day, the way that we function? There's a full reality beyond what we experience in the here and now. He's saying, if there is no Yahweh, if there's nothing behind the curtain, beyond the sun, if there is no God, then this whole thing is pointless. Look at it. It's just, tomorrow is going to be just as bad as today. We're going to see the same mistakes over and over again. You're going to chase the same things with your eyes and your ears, and you're never going to be full if there's nothing beyond the sun. But he ends the book of Ecclesiastes with this in chapter 12. This is giving away the ending. He says this, now all has been heard. This is the very last two verses. We're probably going to see these frequently. Now all has been heard. Here's the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments. This is the duty of all mankind. There is something beyond all of this. It's God. Fear him. Trust him. Obey him. He's going to bring every deed into judgment. It's not exactly like it's woohoo, but he's going to bring every deed into judgment. Now there's good news in this. I'll share in a minute. Every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. You see, all the mistakes, all the sins, all the things, like they don't go on forever unchecked. Which is mine, sure, but it also includes all of those things in the world that I look at and go like, that's terrible. It shouldn't be that way. God says the same thing. It shouldn't be that way. And you know what? The end of the story is this. It's not always going to be that way. It's going to be judged. It's going to be judged. So make sure that we're right with him, with Yahweh. Okay? Make sure that we're right. Now, I get this is big, high-minded idea stuff. So let me just say like three things that I think from this passage that we can do, okay? That we can do. So let me wrap up with this. So what difference does this make? It makes a huge difference in just how we view the world, but it also, I think, makes some difference in the areas that he brought up, okay? And the first thing I want to say is, can we resist hustle culture? Okay, as an act of faith to that God, can we resist hustle culture? What's hustle culture? Hustle culture is the culture we live in that says, you gotta keep working, you gotta keep striving, you gotta keep clawing and scratching to get ahead. You've gotta do what you can do to make the most of your life. It's in your hands. And I think it's an act of faith to resist that urge. We actually follow this God, we follow Yahweh by saying no to that. Okay? In the New Testament, the book of James says, now listen, you who say today or tomorrow we will go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business and make money. Why, you do not even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. James is acknowledging the same truth as the author, teacher in Ecclesiastes. This life, it is brief. And the fact of the matter is, it's soon going to be gone. So when we get all like, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to move forward, and I'm going to make the most of myself, and I'm going to. The act of faith says, take a step back. Take a step back. Trust the God who put you where you are. It doesn't mean be lazy, but it does mean reorienting ourselves to stop and make room for the God who is real, to consider what's beyond the sun rather than just jump on the treadmill and keep running, okay? I think the second idea here, say no to new, okay? Say no to new, like practically say no to new. Don't do something just because it's new and I need to have it or I need to do it. We don't need every shiny new thing. We just don't. But also there's like new ideas. Okay? There's new ideas. Can I encourage you to like read yesterday's news? Just do this sometime. And I mean it like, yeah, go read an old book. Put your phone down. Stop looking at like your news feed that refreshes every time you pull down. Go get an old book. Find something that they were struggling with centuries ago. Read their words, slow down, say no to new. Not because like necessarily their stuff is inherently better than the current stuff, but because it does something to us to break the pattern of I've got to be up to the date. I've got to know. I've got to have this thing right now. It helps us understand their struggles really similar to our struggles. When the teacher says there's nothing new under the sun, I think he's practically encouraging us to look backward. Look backward. We got to wrap this up, okay? I'm going to jump. And then the last thing I would say is remember your true enemy. If there's a God, if there is a Yahweh who's beyond the sun, who's behind the curtain, there's also an enemy. Paul writes in Ephesians chapter 6, he says, put on the full armor of God so that you may take your stand against the devil's schemes. If there's a God, there's a devil. If we're going to accept that there is a God, we need to accept he has an enemy. And that enemy is bent on our destruction because us moving towards him is the thing that he wants to stop at all costs. But it's verse 12, our struggle, the things we struggle with, it's not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in heavenly realms. If there's a God beyond the sun, there's a reality beyond nature, that reality is not just at peace, it's at war for our souls. Get it right. Our true enemy is not that person who disagrees with us or votes differently from us or, you know, goes to that other place or is from that other place. That's not our enemy. Our enemy isn't a person at all. Our enemy is the enemy of God, the enemy of Yahweh, the one who created and gave life to us, the one who makes all of this meaningful. Remember our true enemy. So again, like if we're going to begin the steps of resisting living under the sun, just quick things, right? Quick things. Let's pray together. God, I want to just pause and even this moment acknowledging that we can talk to you. God, I thank you. I thank you that you've given us enough evidence and reason to know that you are here, you are real, and that we're not just we're not just talking about you, we're talking to you. That our lives are not limited by the sun or the veil or the curtain between what we experience with our senses and the reality of the spiritual God, but you are here, you are with us. And I thank you that you are there. You haven't left us alone. God, as we look at some difficult realities, some challenges that we face, if we're going to put our faith in you, would you make it plain Would you make it plain what the consequences are, what the stakes are, what we're challenged to believe about you and to do and following you if you are there. God, give us the faith to trust you. Give us the faith to believe that you're there, not just again in word, but in our lives. And we pray all of this in your name, Jesus. Amen.